A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese, oceans and sunsets. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors looking for a custodian who can help them go further. With all the wealth services, technology, and support an RIA firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabious. Find your match and learn why custody is just the beginning at schwabious.com.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
For decades, the Golden State Killer was the faceless terror of California, a ghost who broke into homes, stole innocence, and vanished. When he was finally caught, the courtroom became the one place where the survivors, after 40 years, could speak directly to the man who destroyed their lives. My guest today isn't just telling that story, he lived it. Sacramento County District Attorney Tien Ho led the prosecution that finally ended the Golden State Killer's reign of silence. And now in his new book, The People Versus the Golden State Killer, he's taking us behind the scenes of the investigation, the trial, and the moral weight of justice. And we're going to go into what went on behind those scenes, behind that curtain today, with your questions, our questions, and really digging deep into the parts of the story that you may have never heard before. Welcome to put your questions in the comments section there on YouTube, and we'll try to get to them throughout our conversation. Tien, welcome to the program, and thanks for taking the time today to join us.
It's an honor for me to be on the show, so thank you so much.
Tien, there's so much to go through and so many questions that I think a lot of us have about this case, where it's at today, how it got here. But I mean, take us back a little bit. I mean, you have lived, a very interesting story, the American immigrant story. You fled Saigon, learned English from scratch. You became the DA. I mean, I want to ask from your perspective, from your prism of everything you've lived through in life to coming into contact with this case, how did that experience and your experience shape the way that you saw this case about the power, the fear, and control that this man wielded for so many years?
You know, we're all a creation of our own history, right? Our personal history, our family's history. Yeah. And as you mentioned, I was born in Vietnam, and I escaped Vietnam after the fall of Saigon on a fishing boat. We ran out of gas, food, and water, drifting on the ocean until we were rescued, and I ended up in a refugee camp. And as you mentioned, when I came to this country as a child, I learned how to speak English by watching Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Oh, wow.
20 years later, graduated from law school. And the reason why I went to law school is I wanted to give back to the greatest country on the face of the earth with the greatest justice system. And so, you know, everything I've ever done in my career was try to give voice to the voiceless. And that's what we try to do. That's what law enforcement tried to do in this very case. They could have given up 20, 30, 40 years ago, but the law enforcement officers kept pursuing him generation after generation. And then when we caught him, it was to help the victims find justice and find their voices and take that back from this monster who craved control because he had very little control and power in his own life.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about how was it? What was the situation where this began to enter your ether, where you first heard about the case, and then when you started being involved in the case, what was going on?
So I've been a prosecutor for 25 plus years, and I've been in Sacramento for 20, California's capital. And when I tried my first homicide in 2012, it was the murder of Rajneet Singh. Raj's body, half naked, was found on a January 1st in the drizzling rain behind a brick wall. And so when I was getting ready for trial, I went out to the crime scene with the lead detective and also my buddy from the office who was on the homicide team, Billy. He grew up in Rancho. And so as we were driving to the crime scene 2012, I see all these bars on every door and every window. I'm like, why are there so many bars everywhere in Rancho Cordova? And that's when they both said it's because of the ear. And I said, the ear? Who's the ear? In Sacramento, the ear means the East Area Rapist. And so my buddy Billy, who grew up there, says, this was the boogeyman of our childhood. And he started talking about the crime and what this guy was doing and how he terrorized the community. And so that was in 2012. Fast forward 6 years later, we caught him and I was assigned the case. And I began to dig into all aspects of the case, his life and the victims as well.
When you look at it, how long this man had that reign of terror and then went silent, but the remnants of the damage was done. For example, the bars on those windows, the stories that we've heard from the victims that were living with that constant fear for so many years, even after the silence, that impact what was there, and nobody knew exactly what was going to happen next, if anything was going to happen next. When you got to kind of dig into the archives of all of this and the investigation over the years, what did you find? And I guess the big question I think a lot of people would have from an inside perspective would be, how did he evade? How did he evade being caught for all of that time? I mean, considering the massive trail of destruction that he left in his wake.
You're talking about 13 known murders, upwards of 50 sexual assaults, 120 burglaries in 11 different jurisdictions up and down the state of California over a 12-year time span. How did he evade capture? His scope was, the scope of his crimes was unfathomable. And how did he evade capture? I think two reasons. Number one was he was a police officer for most of the early part of his crime spree. So he knew about police tactics. He knew how long it would take for the police to arrive on scene, to set up their perimeters on the egress and egress. He knew all the ins and outs of how to escape because he knew that where they would set up their blockade. And so he had an insider perspective and expertise on how to evade capture, how to identify his witness. But then the other problem was back in the 70s and frankly into the 80s and even the 90s, a lot of the law enforcement agencies were siloed. You know, Sacramento didn't talk to Contra Costa. Contra Costa didn't talk to Santa Barbara or Orange County or these other jurisdictions. They were siloed. And so he was able to jump from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and evade capture. You know, in this day and age right now, if you were to commit this sort of crime, you would be caught because we have forensic evidence and everybody has a ring camera or surveillance videos or license plate readers. But this wasn't, you know, you know, 2025. This is 1974, 1975, 1986.
Yeah. Very different time, very different place. And I agree with that. We talk about that quite a bit, I think, where today, I don't know that a lot of these predators of the past, at least in the way that they operated, could operate today because of technology, because of the way that we police things and the way that we can monitor things and the way that we can connect dots. That's if they were to operate under the same way that they had been operating. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are any other people out there today like this that are operating but are more
tech savvy?
Tech savvy are able to evade awareness the same way he did based on the way technology was of that day, or is it just an impossibility in most cases for someone to be able to get away with things like he did in the time period that he did?
You can still have these sort of predators in this day and age. I see two categories. One is the truck driver, right? The one that goes from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, mm-hmm. That's difficult to piece together. And the other one would be somebody that preys upon the people in our community, in our society that are on the margins, right? That somebody may not be missing, whether they're a victim of human trafficking or drugs or living on the streets. And then nobody notices when they're gone because they're already gone. And then the other thing is you have to literally commit a crime without your cell phone on you. The cell phone right now, even when you turn it off, it's pinging to the towers. Even if you don't have it on or in silent mode, it's constantly watching you, looking at you. You have to leave it somewhere else. And the other interesting thing is if we zero in on you and you have this period of time where your cell phone is always in use,
yep.
and then all of a sudden it's shut off, right? Or during the time period that you're committing the crime, that's a red flag.
Easily.
And we have technology right now where we call it basically a tower dump. Have you heard of a tower dump?
Yep. Yeah.
Right. So a tower dump for your listeners that don't know is your phone is pinging off a tower. So let's say it's pinging off a tower that's 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of nowhere and a crime is occurring at that point. So we will do a tower dump of all the phones that are pinging off of that tower during that 1 hour around it. And any phone that's pinging off because there are very few people in the area at 2 a.m, that's our list of suspects. Now, it won't work if you're on I-5, you know, right next to the LAX airport because there's so many people there, you know, at 7 o'clock in the morning. But that's just another tool we have. But you can get away with crime. It's just more difficult.
As a DA, are you surprised at the amount of criminals who are not tech literate or they don't even be very tech literate that still feel the need, that urge that they still have to have their cell phone next to them while committing the crime when that is what is likely going to get them caught in so many ways, or at least place them there? It seems to be such an obvious thing, but it seems there's so many cases where it's like, mm-hmm. that's the one thing you forgot, that your cell phone is going to ping somewhere and tell us where you are.
You know, if you were smart, you wouldn't be committing crimes.
Sure.
Right.
And so, I mean, we're dealing with a subset of individuals here that are more likely to get caught because of it. And it's rare that you get somebody as meticulous, rare that you get somebody as smart, as detail oriented as the Golden State Killer.
Tan, was that a reason that you were able to zero in on him other than the DNA? Excuse me. Because it seemed like there was a pattern here that this was a smart individual. He was evading capture. He was not being identified. Does law enforcement start looking inward saying, you know, it could be one of us? And it takes me to the movie Speed. You know, like it wasn't a retired cop who was doing this.
So a great question, by the way. They had done a series of profiles, at least two profiles, one of which was by the FBI. And the profile back in the 70s and the 80s determined or opined that he was a former cop or in the military, right? And lo and behold, he was in the military and he's a former cop with a criminal science degree. And in fact, the book starts off covering the Visalia Ransacker series. And that was a series of burglaries, 120 of them in a 3-mile square radius from 1974 to 1975, and are culminating in the murder of Professor Claude Snelling in the attempted kidnapping of his 16-year-old daughter and the shooting of a police officer as well. But what came out from that was Officer McGowan was on a stakeout. And that evening, when they came face to face with each other, the ransacker, the Golden State Killer, Joseph D'Angelo, an officer, his mask was off. And so the officer was able to see the Visalia ransacker and said that his face looked familiar. Mm-hmm. Well, at that time, Joseph D'Angelo was a police officer in a nearby town, and he had helped out on the task force to find the ransacker. And he was, in fact, the ransacker.
Wow.
And you can't make that stuff up, right?
No.
And the moment his face was seen, D'Angelo leaves that police force, moves up and becomes a police officer 30 minutes outside of Sacramento. And that's when the East Area Rapist crime spree happens up in Sacramento.
Because it was almost going to be kind of what I was going to ask you a question of, because you were talking about, you know, he has the knowledge of the police force behind him. And knowledge is one thing, but having the power of it is another. And that right there is a clear example of how he used the power of it to avoid being captured as the ransacker. Are there other examples in his story of terror over these years where it wasn't just the knowledge that he used to evade being captured, but the power to steer investigations or to steer people in a different direction other than him when they got too close?
There are plenty of examples of that during his East Area Rapist crime spree. He had a particular MO. He would break into the home. Well, first of all, let me take a step back. His first crimes in Sacramento when he was committing the sexual assault often involved just one person at home, a single female. And so the PIO, the public information officer for the sheriff's department, says, oh, he's targeting single women living at home. Immediately, he switches his MO, and he starts targeting husband and wives couples. So he would break in about 1 o'clock in the morning with the husband and wife in bed. He shine a flashlight on them with a gun. He says, freeze, don't move. I'm just here for drugs and money. I live in a van down by the river. I'll be gone. So he gave that story of a drug addict, and he would sometimes act like a drug addict, right? Where's the drugs? Where are the drugs? To throw the scent off of him. And so what he'll do is he'll do that. He'll throw the pre-tied shoelaces to the wife to tie up the husband. Then he would tie up the wife. He would go through the house. He'd eat their food, drink their beer. He would ransack the house. And then eventually he would come back and separate the wife from the husband. He would sexually assault her. He would lay blankets on top of the husband, who was forced on all fours, and told the husband and stacked plates and bottles and said, if I hear anything fall or break, I'll kill everybody in the family. And then sometimes he would start talking to himself as if there was somebody else in the room. So he did things like that to sprinkle little pieces of different information to throw people off his track. The other thing that he did was he would scope out the area extensively beforehand. He would oftentimes break into that home that he targeted a couple of days before, leave an item in the seat cushion and come back to see if they found it or take something. So he was the ultimate predator of human beings, watching, stalking them before he actually committed his crimes.
Was it... When you look at this and you try to psychologically evaluate what the hell's going on here, the psychological torture, the mental torture, and then his phone calls, too, that he would make after the fact with some of these victims, just to continue to torture them. Ultimately, obviously, that is about control for a predator. But it is so dark, and so many move on to their next victim, unless they're going to keep going back to the same. But what do you think, when you try to put yourself in the shoes of a monster like this, what is his goal? Is it just to instill fear? Is it ultimately just the darkest form of control that one can have, and that's how he fed?
Tony, that's a great question. You know, I have a chapter in the book called The Monster Behind the Mask. right? And so when I got the case, one of the first things we did was we decided to try to recreate every aspect of his life, you know, from when he was born in Bath, New York, to when he was arrested and, you know, and put in jail. And even when he was in jail, we were watching him. But what it was he felt very little control and power in his own life. And because of that, he had to exert that over other people. So when he was a child, when he was a young boy, he witnessed his little sister being raped on a military base by two service members. And he was tied down and held down during that process. He was beaten by his parents. I mean, the fact of the matter is these things happened to him. And so now when he grew up, he became a police officer. And he felt as if the law didn't apply to him. It was his way of exerting, as a police officer, control over other people when he didn't have it. The other thing was, a number of the victims said that he had an extremely small penis and a micro penis. And so when I got the case, what we did was we went, executed a search warrant and took photos of his genitalia, and they were extremely small. And so he felt very powerless in his own life in so many different ways that now he's playing God, because he would tie people up. He would drink their beer, eat their food. And when he left, after sexually assaulting and violating their relationship and marriage, he'd take one earring and leave the other one behind as a reminder. He'd take the wedding band. And so these were his forms of control. And then when he was in Southern California, he killed all the witnesses, but you can see there he's holding their lives in his hand as he is about to pull the blanket over their head and bludgeon them to death with a log or a brass sprinkler head. And so he was playing God. And that's what he wanted to do, was to get some of that control. Now, regardless of what made a monster, he is still a monster that needs to be held accountable.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's basically the recipe. And the recipe, you know, it is the end result. It doesn't excuse what's made out of that recipe, but it starts to make a lot more sense psychologically as to how you can get somebody like this. Mm-hmm. What did you discover about his life while he was doing this? He was a father. He had been married. I know he did get divorced at some point. But what was life like, you know, with the kids on the normal side of things, where nobody had any clue that this was this monster hiding behind the facade of a father and a police officer?
So for 99% of his known crimes, they were committed before he became a father.
Mm-hmm.
And he was married and in a relationship with his wife for a significant portion or for all of the portion of the known crimes. But the fact of the matter is, when we started digging into his marriage and his family life, he lived a very separate life under the same roof from his wife. She was going to law school at first. And then she became a lawyer. He was a police officer. And then he was a mechanic, unemployed for a period of time after he was fired as a police officer for shoplifting a hammer and dog repellent. But they lived separate lives, separate schedule. And I honestly believe that his wife, who is fairly absorbed in her own life and her own person, mm-hmm. did not know that he was the East Era rapist, the original Night Stalker and the Golden State Killer. But he was prolific. He was a police officer by day and a serial killer and serial rapist by night. I don't think he ever slept.
Wow. And that had to make him a little bit even more unstable, that lifestyle, just feeding into that frenzy.
Absolutely. But the seeds of that started much earlier. You know, I covered a portion of his teenage years, and there's a little piece of evidence, a fact, a story in the book that has never been revealed before. And it just shows you his depravity. At one point when he was around the age of 17, he used to collect, it's gross, but he would carry around a jar full of women's pubic hair. I mean, that's how weird and sick he was, right, as a teenager. And he was showing that off as a trophy, right? And that's why whenever he committed his crime, he always took a trophy. But his sexual depravity didn't end. even when he became an old man after he was arrested. I have video of him in his jail cell when he was 72 years old, and he's standing there. There's this young, blonde, female worker who was delivering food in the pod area, and he's standing there looking at her, leering at her, and he begins to masturbate to her. So even at the age of 73, he had not lost the sexual depravity that drove him when he was much younger.
Wow.
Jesus. All because of a micro penis. That's what it comes down to, it seems like, in this. Like, it's because of that insane insecurity that turned into, wow, and then a very, very broken brain. So many questions about a lot of that, but we can move forward. The way that he seemed to be almost a chameleon, it sounds like, in a lot of his life, where he could be a cop, then he could be a mechanic, and then he could be a loving dad. We learned before the show, Stacey, you were looking up information about the daughters, and the daughters had said loving father, right? I mean,
the best father you could ever have is what one of them said.
And obviously, we know in the greater context of things what a monster he was, but it's such a stark contrast to how he could be a different human being to different people. And that really starts to make you wonder, gosh, what kind of a depth can this be? And then we saw the version of him in court as well. I know in the book you had mentioned that you believe he was trying to fake insanity while obviously that was part of the defense, but also when he was in court, when we saw those images of him, those videos of him, he looks like this frail old man that's barely present. All an act, you say. Tell me about what you witnessed in that scope of things.
He is the master manipulator. He has manipulated everybody in his inner circle and outer circle. A couple hours before he was arrested, we had a surveillance team following him. And he was out there jumping in and out of his boat. A few days before that, he was on his motorcycle at the age of 72, weaving in and out of traffic, going 80 miles an hour, doing counter-surveillance moves. And suddenly we arrest him, and he's sitting there, almost as if he is in a comatose state in the interrogation room. They wheel him into the courtroom, and he's in a wheelchair, laid back with his mouth ajar, breathing out of his mouth like a fish, you know, on the ground. And it was all an act, because literally, as he's doing that in the courtroom, I have video of him walking into his cell with a cane, okay? Have you guys ever seen the movie The Usual Suspects?
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes.
And that scene where he's walking out of the police station. So I have a video of D'Angelo, the Golden State Killer, hobbling in, barely limping as he's walking in with a cane to a cell. The moment the door closes, the cane goes down. He's doing jumping jacks. He's moving around. He's climbing up and down his, you know, his bunk bed. He is the master manipulator. He's been that way his entire life. The people that really, really know him see the monster behind the mask. And so that's who he is. And the only time that we really get a glimpse of him is in those quiet moments when he's in his cell thinking that he's alone and nobody's watching. I mean, I had videos of him. Literally, he would walk in a triangle for like 2 hours straight, 18 steps, nearly every footstep in the same spot, just methodical, like an animal cage that's ready to pounce.
It sounds like just animal instincts on a monster like this.
Yeah. Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.